Welcome to the City of Ocala Finance Committee meeting. Sorry, Investment Committee meeting. Finance, I do with the complex. Go ahead and get started. We have five members here. And want to approve the minutes?
I'll make a motion.
Second?
I'll second it.
All in favor?
Aye.
Go ahead and jump right into the report. Ms. Sawgrass, sir.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. I'm going to touch on Q3, absolutely. I'd be somewhat remiss if I could touch a little bit on October. I don't want to jump ahead to the next quarter so much, but I know there could be a lot of questions about what's happening in October. On the same themes that we're going to discuss from Q3, and we discussed really in prior quarters and prior years, really, are somewhat came to a T in October, which wasn't really that surprising. Look at it in hindsight, maybe the speed that everything happened, how quickly things transpired was a little bit surprising, but for the most part, a lot of the factors we've already discussed in prior quarters came somewhat of a head. But we'll get into that a little bit as I discuss Q3 as well. So Q3 was another very strong quarter for the U.S. economy and for markets. We had U.S. GDP growth at 4.2% year over year. There are some one-off factors that play into that, such a strong number with that over 4%, which we haven't had since 2014. There was some one-offs. You had the tax cut that came in. That gave a little bit of a shot of an arm to the economy. So a little bit of that is built in, especially on a year-over-year basis. You also had some other factors with tariffs coming in. You had some exports. So a lot of companies increased their exports, especially in the commodities, to try to get it out before some of those tariffs hit. So it was probably a little bit higher than it normally would be. However, with that said, very strong number. We just recently had about a 3.5% hit come in for the prior quarter. Again, a lot of revisions, but that's probably more in line with what we're seeing. It's above 3%, which is kind of the goal right now. So even if it's slightly inflated with some one-off factors, still, again, very strong number, and the economy keeps chugging along, as we've seen in the past. Unemployment at 3.7% continues to come down. Again, we had another strong job number just come in. There was even some better underlying. The participation rate was increasing as well, which is a positive. Meaning more people are coming into the workforce and becoming employed. Really, across the labor numbers across the board are extremely positive. Just the amount of people that are available for jobs. I was talking to somebody, a friend of mine, who works in an employment agency, and she just said it's just hard. There's just not many people out there to find jobs for. Which is unfortunate for her, but you know, in the grand scheme of things, it's very positive for the labor market. So we're definitely seeing some positives there. Corporate earnings continue to grow. We've seen that even again in this quarter. I'll get into a little bit about some of the language we're seeing and some of the slowdowns we expect, and that's playing into a little bit of the sell-off we've seen. But as it related to Q3, continued strong growth, you know, from the economy and from companies specifically. Consumer confidence and business confidence all very high, especially on the small business side. That's really one factor that we've seen kick in lately. Those small businesses able to get loans, able to grow, really a driving force of the economy that isn't really talked about very much, especially when talking about the stock market. Really those small businesses that are really continuing to drive the economy from the bottom up. One interesting thing we've seen, and it's continued even so, the diversion between what's happening in the U.S. and what you're seeing in the rest of the world. Europe especially, we're seeing some conflicts going on with Italy specifically. I'm not to get into too much detail, but they've had their share of issues, as has Greece, as has Spain in the past. So it's been not necessarily contained within the Eurozone, and different countries are having different issues, a lot of which are somewhat related. Italy's trying to come out of some issues they've had, and they've got a new government coalition that attempted to pass a budget, which included a lot of spending. And the Eurozone as a whole is essentially saying, no, you've got yourself into the situation by piling on debt. Adding more debt and adding more spending isn't necessarily the way to get out of it. They're looking more of a kind of a strict austerity, cut back the budget. Similarly, we saw with Greece, and that, of course, you know, causes some other issues, and you've got some populist type of politicians that are in now that don't want to go that route necessarily. So it's a bit of a conflict as we see right now. That Italy-specific debt has widened out pretty substantially. A lot of Italian banks own, about 10% of the Italian debt is owned by the banks. So if that continues to underperform, and you know, the worst case scenario has been kind of taking a haircut on that, or whatever the case may be, those banks are going to be affected. That then spreads to, you know, across Europe, and then how does that affect the U.S. and so forth. So there's a lot of conflicts that are going on right now that it remains to be seen how that affects the U.S. and the rest of the world. I think one thing it definitely does is it continues to make the U.S., even if the U.S. has some issues as well, it makes the U.S. the safe haven, and money from Europe and other parts of the country will continue to come into the U.S. That could prop up markets. It also could prop up the bond market, especially on the long end. So that could act, as we've seen before, that could act as a bit of an anchor on the long end of the bond market or the treasury market as people pile into those as a bit of safe haven. It also increases the value of the dollar, which is, you know, impacts other things as well. So as I discussed some of the world events, one thing that has been a topic and continues to be so is the trade deals and the tariffs. We did have in Q2, we had a resolution with Canada and Mexico in terms of a trade deal. When it came down to it, it's probably not going to be that much different than what we saw from NAFTA. It's a little bit of a tweak. But most important, I think, from the market standpoint, is to just get it out of the way. Even if it was the same deal, let's not have the uncertainty of tariffs. Let's not have the uncertainty of trade deals. So just having that something passed, which, to be fair, hasn't happened yet. It still does require approval from Congress, which should come, at least the vote should come later in the year. If that does happen, and the fact that it's moving along at least is a positive for the markets. One resolution that has not come to pass so far is the trade deal with China. And that's been a lot more, the impact's been a lot larger. It wasn't affecting the markets as much. We've seen that change really most recently. China's a huge impact on the world. Forgetting the U.S. markets for a second, any impact on the Chinese markets and the Chinese economy really affects the global economy. About a third of the global growth over the last year was driven from China. So if that, it's not just how it impacts the U.S., it's how does it impact China, and then of course, how does that, you know, impact the whole world? There's still a lot of talk. We had some language come out, some optimism come out late in the week last week. I think a lot of that was taken with a grain of salt as we head into midterms. A lot of it was maybe just some optimism, you know, trying to get the markets propped up a little bit. Over the weekend, a lot of that was that optimism has probably tapered off a little bit. So it does remain to be seen what's going to happen with the trade deal in China. We saw just this quarter, and to jump ahead a little bit, but in October, we saw about a third of the companies that reported in the S&P all mentioned tariffs to some degree in their earnings reports and in their earnings calls. So clearly it's on the mind of a lot of companies and the mind of a lot of investors. And then you saw it in the bottom line as well in companies such as Caterpillar, Ford, Harley-Davidson, all of them mentioned specifically the cost of steel or other commodities, prices going up, what it could mean for costs, what it could mean for the consumer. So it does appear now as if that's starting to trickle in to the economy and into specific companies and the customer, of course, in the end as well. So again, interesting to see how that impacts going forward. I think companies continue to press on that, and if that maybe forces a deal at some point and some kind of capitulation from both sides, hopefully in the next few months or so. But Q3, again, very positive, even with some of those factors aside. The S&P, the Dow, and the NASDAQ all reached all-time highs. The S&P was up 7.7%. The NASDAQ was led, as usual, by the FANG stocks, so Facebook, Amazon, Alphabet, which is Google, and Netflix, continue to just really go just at a blistering pace. Apple reached the $1 trillion market cap. It was the first U.S. company ever to do so. It was a huge deal. It was all over the news. They had, you know, those parties going on. It was very exciting stuff. 3 weeks later, Amazon did the same thing. So not as much, but still, it's silly to some degree, just how much these companies have grown. Great companies, great business models. I think we've seen a little bit of that taper off again. These really led the downturn in October. Not to say that they're not great companies, but the valuations on these companies got a little bit out of control, most likely. I think when you have such a run-up like that, it leaves your margin of error very slim. So Apple, for example, just came out with earnings, and their iPhone estimates, sales estimates, were slightly below what people had expected. I think the exact number people had expected was about 45.5 million, and they sold 44.9. They sold 45 million iPhones. And I think we all know what iPhones cost these days.
Yeah.
So the company's doing fine. We own you know, Apple bonds, we have no issues with that. They're short term. The cash flow is still extremely high. But, you know, with that said, in terms of how it's going to affect the markets, any slight, when you get to this point, when things are going so good, people ignore the bad news. And when things start to take a little bit of a turn and things have gone good for so long, there's more of a focus on some of the slightly bad news. So your margin of error is a little bit slimmer. I think we've seen that happen a little bit in October. But, you know, again, for the year and over the long term period, stocks have done very well. These tech companies have done very well, but probably was time for just a little bit of a correction there. In terms of the third quarter, the Barclays aggregate was up by 2 basis points, so pretty flat for the quarter. A lot of that was give and take between interest rates and corporate bond spreads. Corporate bond spreads, as the equity market did in that risk-on environment, performed very well. Investment grade bonds were up almost 1%, about 97 basis points. So it kind of gives you an idea of how much interest rates going up and the price impact that had negatively impacted the overall bond market. We had the 2-year up by almost 30 basis points, the 10-year up by 20, and the long line up by about 22. So again, another quarter we've had interest rates going up, and I'll get a little bit more into that. But it was really a give and take between the risk-on assets of equities, investment-grade bonds. High-yield bonds were up like 2.5%. So really this beta-driven, market-driven rally that we saw, coupled with that, were interest rates moving up for a lot of reasons, which, again, I'll get into that a little bit. But that give and take for the quarter. In terms of the Fed, they raised rates again for the third time. We fully expect a fourth raise coming in Q4. I would argue that it's already somewhat priced in. This is their eighth hike since 2015. I'm going to jump over a little bit to some of the slides here, which I want to get into. Just to talk about, there's been a lot of talks about, is the Fed going too fast? Did they stop raising rates? What kind of impact is it having? So when the Fed started raising rates in 2015, the premise of what they're trying to do is essentially normalize the economy, normalize growth. And somewhat as the economy was taking off so strong, and even back in 15, the equity market was rallying, the point of raising rates is to somewhat constrict things a little bit, not make corporate borrowing so easy, not make the equity market cap of companies escalate to the point that they did, somewhat increase volatility. In a good way. You just don't want things, you don't want a bubble to continue to form and then to burst and everything gets so volatile like that. So it's really to normalize earnings, to normalize the economy. So you can argue, since that point, this is their eighth rate hike. This is corporate bond spreads. So the ability of companies to borrow has continued to go down. Equity has rallied significantly, almost in a complete linear fashion up until October, of course. But, you know, for the most part, we had a continuous rally for the last 3 years or so. And then again, the labor market, which you expect to slow down and more normalize. And I mentioned before some of the labor numbers, and this is in 2010, there were 7 unemployed workers per job. In 15, that was about, 2.5, 3. Now it's at 1. So, I could have picked many, many slides in terms of the labor market. But, so I guess the point is, you can argue as much as the Fed has done, it hasn't had much of an impact at this point. So, to argue, I guess, that they're going to stop raising rates for us it isn't as valid, because I think there's still a ways to go for that, for them to accomplish what their goals are in terms of, not necessarily, you want to slow down the growth of the economy. It's a fine balance between, of course, not going too far, and you don't want to do nothing and have a bubble form. So, in our opinion, even with, these are, of course, our Q3 slides, but even including the correction we've had and the sell-off we've had in October, I would still argue we've had a significant rally in equity markets. Corporate bond spreads are still relatively tight compared to where they were. So I think there's still demand there for the Fed to keep going into 2019 as well. We expect another 3, the market's even saying 4 rate hikes in 2019. So the economy is still on very strong footing. I think there's still a ways, for the Fed to go. And you're seeing a lot of other, it's not just the Fed now, you're seeing other parts of the world as well. We're doing that at the Bank of England and the European Union, even with some of the things they've had, the issues they've had with Italy and Brexit is still continuing to go on, hoping for some kind of resolution there. But a lot of volatility across the world, but other parts of the world are continuing to lay off the quantitative easing, maybe not to the same extent that the U.S. has, but continuing to kind of lay off some of that easing that they were administering. Some other facts, and I mentioned rates to Fed, and I mentioned if you keep moving up, that's going to impact the front end of the curve for sure, and that's really, in terms of your portfolio, the biggest impact it's going to have. We expect rates to continue to go up as the Fed keeps moving. And just some other factors. We've got, with the tax cuts that came in order to essentially keep the government going, they're going to have to keep increasing Treasury supply, and they've done so. Another $1.5 trillion or so for 2019. I've expected that actually would just increase as well. We've had a couple auctions, Treasury auctions come up recently that have come up a little bit higher in terms of issuance. So there's going to be this continued supply of Treasuries in the market, and you counter that with the fact that the Federal Reserve is actually decreasing their balance sheet. So whereas before they were continuing to buy, they were the largest buyer of the Treasury securities, they're no longer doing that. So you take out the largest buyer of Treasury securities, and you have this increased issuance, so maybe a little bit less demand, higher supply, that in turn could and probably should increase interest rates on the long end of the curve, especially. You've got the foreign demand is not going to be as high as it was, potentially cannot be as high as it was, depending on what happens. If things resolve themselves in Europe a little bit, there's not going to be as much demand coming from the rest of the world. That's you know, we don't know what's going to happen there. It could go either way, depending on how things unfold. But I mentioned other countries raising rates as well. So the U.S. standing at a 3% yield right now in the 10-year, and the other countries were essentially zero. That's no longer the case. So it doesn't look as attractive from a pure yield standpoint. So there could be some kind of risk-off in other countries that pile money into the U.S., but just in terms of rates and how attractive they look, it's not the same story as it has been in the past. So just some factors to consider. Okay, this is just some further slides just talking about the deficit and kind of what we're facing and what we could be looking at in the future. So the positives. We've had yields go up across the market, and across that's going to impact your portfolio as well. So the positive for that is the yield to maturity on your portfolio has increased along with that. And going back about 5 years when you were looking at a sub 1% yield to maturity on the portfolio, now you're almost 3% in September. Now you add that in October, it's over 3%, about 3.07 as we stand right now. So unfortunately, when rates were so low, you had very low absolute returns. Then you had rates moving up, and when that happens, you were looking at low returns, potentially negative returns. Now we're sitting at a higher yield to maturity. So even if rates continue to move up as they have, you somewhat have a little bit of a buffer there with that higher yield to somewhat counter that price movement. I think that's what we're looking at right now. Look at Q3, and you had a 43 basis point return in the short portfolio. You annualize that over four quarters, it's at almost 2%. So even with rates moving up, and I mentioned 2 years was up almost 30 basis points, really a staggering move on the front end of the curve that you don't see very often. Even with that type of movement, you still had a positive return, and it was almost 40-45 basis points of return. So I think that's the type of return the type of performance we're going to see going forward. Even if we have rates move up and we have spreads stay where they are, even widen a little bit, you've got this higher yield to maturity that's going to provide a lot of that return for you and somewhat serve as a buffer even in these raising rate environments. So, looking over the long term, again, low returns outperforming the benchmark in terms of your portfolio with Sawgrass, but we do hope that we're sitting at higher yields now, that these absolute returns will generate higher for sure. I talked about the yield curve a little bit, but it is pretty staggering just to see how much we've come in a year. I know there's a lot of numbers here, but just to give you some context, the two-year, year-over-year from 9/30/17 to 9/30/18, is up 131 basis points. The long bond's only up 31 basis points. And I know we've talked about some of the tightening and the yield curve inversion aspects of it. It is pretty staggering. We expect, again, with the Fed continuing to raise rates, we do expect that to continue. However, I will say, I think there's more talk now of the neutral rate. So the Fed is trying to find essentially the rate where everything is equal. There's a balance between the economy growing, not growing too fast, and not slowing it down too much, there is talk about now finally reaching that neutral rate, hoping for sometime in, you know, 2020, maybe we'll have some more clarity by next year in terms of when that may be. Even if they continue to raise rates in 19 through the end of the year, maybe by mid-year, there's at least more clarity of when that's going to end. Now, I would guess we're in the seventh inning or so of Fed hikes, and hopefully there's a little bit more clarity in terms of when all this is going to end, and then that'll price in the market, and then we can, that's when your yield will be more in line with your actual performance, and you'll start to see those higher absolute return numbers. I think I've touched on this a little bit. This is just corporate bond spreads continuing to tighten. We've seen it on a quarter-to-quarter basis, and this is going back to 2015, to where we sit right now, really almost at all-time highs. This has come out a little bit in October. I'll get into that a little bit, but in terms of compliance, we're all clear. I know we had to take some money most recently, so we managed to stay in compliance as well with that. Duration, I'll touch a little bit on. You see your duration right now is about 2. Compared to the benchmark at about 265. We typically have been about 80% duration. Our yield has gone there, it's lagging a little bit. We've increased that to get more in line with the index a little bit. But for us, the most important thing is protect your principal, you know, protect your portfolio in these rising interest rate environments. I think we've done a good job of. We're going to stay short duration most likely until, again, we see a little bit more clarity in terms of Fed hikes. If that happens in next year, and we think that the rate moves are done, I think you'll see a shift more to closer neutral duration, more equal with the benchmark. And we'll probably stay in the corporate bond spreads. We've had some widening in October, and that's okay. You know, we probably expected a little bit of it. Our goal is to keep you extremely high quality. The corporate bonds in your portfolio outperform the overall market of corporate bonds because they're higher quality. They're not going to have as much impact when you have a little bit of that volatility. So we want to keep that yield up for you guys to generate your performance, but we want to make sure we protect it as well, given the current state of the environment. I think that hopefully pretty much covers it. I'll just say, in terms of your portfolio in October, we made some small moves. We're not going to overreact. We think, again, your bonds specifically outperformed. We like where we are. We made some small tweaks, I guess. We sold some, as I mentioned before. We're doing some swaps. We think there's been a little bit of opportunities to move out a little bit on the curve where you can. Just not, you know, maybe a two-year bond to a 3 or 4 year bond to pick up a little bit of yield. If it's a name that we like, that's maybe, I mentioned Apple, for example. Their bonds were going to widen out a little bit because they had an earnings miss. There's been a little bit of volatility in that space. We love Apple. It's a great company. We're not going to overreact, and I think we'll sell out of that. They're sitting at bonds, I think, that were fairly valued, maybe widened out a little bit too much because of the environment we're in. We feel perfectly comfortable with those type of bonds. If we see an opportunity there, we can pick up a little bit of yield and move out on the curve just by a year or two, we're going to take advantage of that. So a little, you know, tweaks like that in the portfolio, but I think for the most part, we're very comfortable with where we sit right now.
Hey, are there any concerns about the expanding deficit? I mean, is it really the economy?
Yeah, absolutely. There it is. I mentioned the Treasury issuance supply. I almost want to say it's not getting enough attention right now. I think that'll change. It's fine when the economy is going good, and everyone assumes that the economy is going to pick up and that's going to pay off the deficit. That's typically not how that works. That, you know, I know that's a lot of the rhetoric that comes with tax cuts, that the economy will pay off, and that historically just hasn't proven to be the case. So yes, I would say there's becoming a larger concern. If there's a bit of a downturn in the, putting the stock market aside, because the markets fluctuate up and down, if there's a little bit of a downturn in the economy and you've got a large deficit that can't be funded by, you know, stronger employment numbers, stronger income, just, you know, tax-paying community, basically, that will most definitely be a concern, I think, going forward.
Okay. Very positive report.
Thank you. Great.
Motion to accept.
And make all motion.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Next, we'll go to TSM.
Thank you.
We have Scott Stitcher and Jason Bond. Yeah, Scott's going to present.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I will try not to be too redundant, David's comments. I'm going to just speak briefly to the two-year, because I think the two-year acts as a nice proxy for our portfolio. So just by way of reminder, we do the 1 to 3 year portion of your portfolio along with the yield curve. So again, David hit on some of this already, the fact that interest rates did rise during the course of the quarter. During the third quarter, the two-year was up about 29 basis points. The second quarter, the two-year was up about 26 basis points, and over the past year, about 133 basis points. So we've seen 10 straight quarterly increases in the two-year, and that range now stands, for the Fed funds rate range now stands at 2 to 2.25. So that is a little painful for a short managed portfolio or a short investor like yourselves, because as those interest rates rise, principal falls. But as David alluded to, that now we're at a point where you're earning more income to buffer those price movements. So we are at a much better place than we were a year ago, 18 months ago, 2 years ago. We too think that if you were to look at the dot plot, that we will see another rate hike in December. The dot plot would tell you that we will get one more before the year's over, taking the range to 2.25 to 2.5. And again, if you're a believer in the dot plot, then you would say that there's going to be anywhere from 3, and some even will say now 4 rate hikes in 2019. But I will say, I think the Fed has been very transparent that they will remain data dependent. So meaning as the economy continues to chug along, like David alluded to, strong employment growth and GDP growth, and everything seems to remain, I'll call it in a Goldilocks scenario where we're not too hot, not too cold, then we will continue to see the Fed take action and raise rates in 2019. And then again, David kind of alluded to the fact that they're trying to get to that neutral rate again, that Goldilocks scenario.
When's the last time we had a neutral rate?
Anytime the neutral rate is essentially when they stop. Yeah, it's a lot of, I guess, argument about what that means.
What that really is, right?
Yeah,
right.
If it actually exists, it's not even. But
is it defined by duration? How long it stays neutral like that? That is greater.
It's not necessarily. Different Fed governors probably have different opinions on it. That sounds vague, but this is actually recently it's been a topic of what is neutral rate.
Yeah.
But it probably is the last time that they essentially stopped, which is pretty. Unless you want to, you'd argue that when it was at zero, it was a neutral rate, but that was a unique situation. But it would have been pre-recession when they would have, maybe it was 05 or 06.
Yeah.
Sometime ago.
Yeah.
So as you said, it's kind of unknown what that is, and even so, some of the rhetoric out of the Fed has stated that they might be willing to even kind of blow past this neutral rate, so to speak. And the thought being there that maybe they just need the ability to lower rates if we were to hit a rough patch. So there, again, it's sort of an arbitrary number. Much of what Fed does is somewhat arbitrary at times. Their 2% inflation target. Time will tell. Time will tell. I'm stopped on a slide here I thought was kind of interesting too, kind of just bring back the point of where we are in today's environment, that now you can buy a 6-month piece of CP earning almost the same as a 1-year treasury, a 1-year corporate earning in line with a 5-year treasury. So that it's just amazing where we are today, especially for us being on the short end. We're able now to kind of buy, say, a 2 or 3 year piece of paper and pick up 85% of the yield of a 5-year instrument. So what does that mean? Well, we're able to
earn almost as much as a five-year instrument, but not take on that additional interest rate risk in the market. So that bodes well for, again, a short-term fixed income investor like yourself. Again, as painful as it has been in the near term, you're starting to see sort of the fruits of the Fed's labor here. Let's get in, again, I didn't want to be too redundant there, but let's get into the statistics of your portfolio, which is what you're really most interested in seeing. You'll see that we ended the quarter with a market value of $52,202,000. The yield at market at 2.85%, and the yield at cost now almost at a full 2% in the portfolio. So again, it's something to mature, we sell, we reinvest, we're able to buy at a higher yielding, buy a higher yielding security, and you start to see that yield at cost creep up. Duration, we also are maintaining a duration stance short of the benchmark. End of the third quarter, we were at a 162 versus a 177. That's about 90% of the benchmark. I would say you probably see us in that 90, 92, 93% range here again as the Fed continues to take action. Again, high credit quality. You see the breakdown here in the pie chart. These are S&P ratings. So therefore, sometimes you may see something not rated by S&P, but I don't want that to cause any concern that you're out of compliance with your policy. I can promise you that Moody's or Fitch would be carrying a rating that would keep you in compliance. But again, overall credit quality of the portfolio is a double A. You see the sector breakdown here. Corporates, asset backs, treasuries, munis, MBS, mortgage-backed securities, that is, some agencies and agency CMOs make up your portfolio. And then, again, we're the short duration or the 1 to 3 year strategy, so therefore you see the majority of your maturity breakdown is inside that two to three year, I should say inside 3 years. Okay? Let's look at what you're really most interested in seeing, and that is the performance. And for the third quarter, the portfolio earned 0.46% versus the benchmark at 0.2. For about 26 basis points of outperformance on a gross of fee basis, and then about 24 basis points on a net of fee basis. And going out and looking at your fiscal year end, the portfolio earned about 0.52% versus the benchmark at 0.06%, so 46 basis points of outperformance. On gross of fee and 0.38% on net of fee basis. So still not cause for cartwheels yet, but we are approaching those 1 and 2% returns here slowly but surely. So what do we do during the quarter? This looks at the last four quarter ends for your, from a sector standpoint, and I'll focus on end of 2Q versus end of 3Q. And the takeaway here is we were a little bit lighter in corporates quarter over quarter. We increased in the treasury space as well as in ABS. A little lighter in agency as well, you can see here. And that's kind of a consistent theme for us across clients like you. We've been able to take some gains off the table in the agency space and buy either comparable yielding or higher yielding treasury securities. So we can take that kind of credit risk off the table and buy a higher yielding or similarly yielding treasury. So it's been a very good trade for us. And I will say we've become a little more cautious, I guess is a fair way to say it, in the corporate space. So we've been fairly aggressive in adding to corporate over the past 3-4 years. It's just been very beneficial. As the economy does well, credits do well, and credits tend to be less sensitive to interest rate moves, where treasuries and agencies tend to move in lockstep with what the Fed is doing. So we favored corporate in this environment. But as David has alluded to, that, you know, when things start to slow, people become a little more cautious, and we have taken that same stance. So we've, again, lightened corporate where we can, and we're not as aggressively adding to corporate. We do still like asset backs. I mentioned we did increase there. So we, a credit instrument, but we still favor ABS in this environment. So lighter agency, heavier treasury, corporates in line, but again, a little more cautious going forward, we continue to favor asset backs as well. We stop there and just see if there are any questions on performance or actions we took during the course of the quarter in the portfolio. Now I'll just stop briefly and show you again. I mentioned the short duration stance at 1.62 years versus 1.8 years, about 90% of the benchmark. We do have what I call some dry powder here that will mature soon, and we can, again, invest that out longer term to purchase higher yielding securities. Our presentation, our quarterly book, also has transactions in it. And I'll just stop so you can see some of the purchases made during the course of the quarter and just point you out here to the yield at market and just note that, you know, everything is anywhere from a 268 to upwards of 336, 345. Again, just a sign of the times of where we are now. And that, again, will bode well, like, over the long term in the form of higher income in the portfolio. I'll just note, and I won't get into detail because I want to give the last manager sufficient time to speak, but we do include a stress test in the back of the presentation for you all to see. The stress test shows an instantaneous shock to the portfolio and what that would mean in the form of a plus 5 point, I should say a plus 0.5 or minus 0.5 interest rate movement. We show you that on an instantaneous shock standpoint. We also have a 12-month horizon, what it would mean to the portfolio over a one-year time frame. And I'll just point out, you know, again, a sign of the times, we've gotten the majority of the pain behind us. Even a 50 basis point rate hike over the next year, which I think you more than likely will see, would still mean positive earnings from a market value standpoint and a total return percentage standpoint in the portfolio. Again, that's just a sign of that higher income being earned. Okay. Lastly, we show you credit downgrade stress test here. It's probably a little easier to see actually the verbiage here. Downgrading the portfolio's allocations to ABS by one notch from AAA to AA+ would result in policy warning, meaning we wouldn't be out of policy. And then downgrading any allocations to BBB corporate notes would result in a little less than a percent of the portfolio downgraded to BBB minus. It's, again, still within policy limit. Okay? So I think that's good information for you. I just want you to know that it is in our presentation. I'll stop there again and see if there are any questions. If not, that's all I have as far as prepared remarks.
Thank you.
Okay, another positive report.
Thank you, Scott. Sure, thank you.
Motion to accept.
I make a motion.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
All right.
Aye.
Tim Michael with Sites Management.
Farther away you go, the less.
Is that what it is? You want to trade?
Good morning. I'm Kim Mikeley with Sites Investment Advisors. And as the other managers have pointed out, interest rates across the curve rose. And we are a manager that covers the 1 to 10 year states of the yield curve. And so looking like at 5 year treasuries, they were up 22 basis points. The 10 year was up 20. And we ended the year with the 10-year at a 306. We actually saw the 10-year peak at about a 311. And as being your longest duration manager, you know, having an increase in interest rates, that has certainly dampened the returns that we've seen, because a longer duration portfolio is going to be more sensitive to interest rate changes. And so given that we have increases That bodes as negative for this quarter. On a fiscal year-to-date, another thing to keep in mind is that rates increased on the 10-year 73 basis points, so almost a full percentage point. They've gone from a 233 to a 3.06%. So we would consider this quarter a little bit of a reversal from what we saw in the second quarter, in that in the second quarter you had spread widening, in the third quarter we had spreads compressing, as we had talked about. Investment grade and high yield securities did well, and the lower the quality segment in the corporate space, the better the absolute and excess return was. So looking at performance, you can see that for the quarter, the return was 7 basis points versus the index at 15. And I've also incorporated an A-rated or better benchmark, just so that you can see that excluding that triple B space, what the differential in return is, 15 versus versus 3. Given your policy, we're focusing in on the mid triple B area and higher. And so, just so you have an indication, we're not allowed to invest in that lowest quality of triple B, and the differential between a low triple B and a mid triple B for the quarter was 22 basis points. And so that was just something to point out. And on a fiscal year-to-date basis, that differential between low versus mid was 55 basis points. So it's meaningful. I will say, however, that we were underweight corporates, so that was a detractor to performance. But you know, it's a combination balance between the two of what you invest in. So just kind of giving you some information as far as that benchmark encompasses the whole span of low B all the way up to triple A. Looking at the characteristics, we ended the quarter at 55.9 million. The duration, we're pretty much duration neutral. And we're much longer than your other portfolios. So keeping in mind, if you have not quite a full percentage point rise in rates, if you did, you're looking at negative 4%. That's the principal part, and then you have income to offset it. And so now we're at an environment where this portfolio, you're looking at a 3.21 yield at the end of September. The yields increased 22 basis points since last quarter. And keeping in mind that September of 2017, we were at a 2.16. So we've had some major increases in yield over this short period of time, and that's going to continue to help buffer. I think we've kind of took the brunt of much of the increase in yields at this point in time. A few things to highlight as far as our positioning. We remain defensively postured in that we are underweight our corporates. When we look at a contribution to duration, we're at about 0.8 times the index. So again, being underweight corporates and corporates doing well, that was a detractor. However, our security selection within the corporate space was good, and financials did very well for us. Looking at securitized, you can see that we actually have increased our securitized exposure such that we're almost a little bit overweight versus the benchmark. But we are underweight in mortgage-backed securities, which makes up the index. And we are actually using commercial mortgage-backed securities and asset-backed securities. We've gone from about 2.5% to 10.9% this quarter. And that certainly helps as far as a substitution in our mind against government-related. So that has served us well. And another thing to highlight is we are overweight in our treasury exposure. However, our contribution to the ratio was at about 55%, and now we're at 46.5%. So that has come down as far as where we're placing duration for treasuries and putting more of that in that CMBS and ABS side. Are there any questions as it relates to the portfolios and how they're structured?
Kim, I just have one question. On the U.S. Treasury, are they going to continue to decrease that?
We are still overweight when you look at market value.
Right.
But here, from a duration standpoint, it's placement along the curve of where you're putting your treasuries. So I would suspect that, the duration part, I'll say that this in October, well, just actually last week, we have actually reduced some of our corporate exposure even more and placing that into treasuries. And I'll kind of go into that as to that rationale.
Okay.
This is your policy monitor, and we are all within compliance within the various policies noted. And then this is just a highlight as far as our corporate outlook. We continue to be underweight. We looked at fundamentals, technicals, and valuations. Just a few things that I would say that we're looking at. When we looked at 2017, there was very little volatility in the marketplace. As we started out 2018, volatility presented itself with the equity markets in early February. And then that certainly kind of subsided. But we saw global volatility in other areas where you've had spikes in volatility throughout this year. And I know that David had spoken to some of that. We had LIBOR OIS spreads, which is kind of a measure of credit risk in the banking sector. We saw those spike, and we had unwinding and volatility where there's the VIX index where that has spiked. We've had emerging market volatility. We saw volatility within Italy and some of the other foreign entities. And just as of late, in October, we saw the VIX index for U.S. equities begin to spike again. Where we ended, the VIX index is like an equity volatility index. It ended September at 12, and in October, it was at 25. So that may not sound like a big number, but it's a big increase in volatility. And so we would attribute some of this volatility that's presenting itself in the marketplace. First, one being declining central bank liquidity. There's hawkishness from the Powell-led Fed. And then there is a reduction in credit from China. And so just to kind of speak to those points as far as how they're contributing to volatility, you have your major central banks, Fed, European Central Bank, Bank of Japan. All of these developed markets are beginning to reduce their liquidity. And our analysis, when you look at an aggregate global balance sheet, where everybody's been pumping liquidity into the marketplace, and as we move into the fourth quarter of this year, first quarter of 2019, that global central bank balance sheet is going to begin to inflect and contract. So that is something where we're going to see volatility there. As it relates to the Fed, we're seeing a little bit more hawkishness from the Fed because the makeup of the Fed has changed from what we saw last year. And so they appear to, when you see corrections in the market, like we saw this in early February, Fed didn't speak to that. There was a 10% correction. He's seen corrections in October, silence, where I think in the past, where we had Yellen and Bernanke, they were very quickly to kind of speak to the market and kind of give guidance as to what they think. And we're seeing less of that. And we believe that it would really take a sell-off of about 15 to 20% before the Fed may even have some kind of verbal inclination to present to the market. And that would be something where it would have to be a sell-off in a very short period of time. And so I guess that's causing a little bit of volatility. And then we have China. China's been a big source of credit and liquidity in the past, and they're certainly cutting back on their credit creation, and they're trying to really de-lever their economy, and that reverberates throughout the world, particularly with their de-levering. They're also not buying as much commodities. And emerging markets sell a lot of commodities to China. They're the big buyer. And if they're not buying as much, then that's going to affect the markets, and it becomes a reverberation, if you will. So just kind of circling back to the U.S. economy, I kind of feel that Powell, we've got a different person in place than the previous predecessors. And he's really not shying away from raising rates and trying to take some risk, air out of the risk markets. We've kind of been in a period where there's been imbalances, where we've had this very accommodative policy for too long, and certainly trying to get us back to, in their mind, a better place. And we've had 200 basis points of rate increases since December of 2015. And we call that, they look at financial conditions, and there's an index called the Goldman Sachs Financial Conditions Index. And that index right now is looser than when they began this process. And that is due to, which is good. I mean, the Fed, if they're seeing conditions being loose, then it allows them the ability to keep raising rates. And what we have seen is the stock market going up. We've seen credit spreads tighten and the dollar weaken. And those are all indications in that global Goldman Sachs Financial Conditions Index. And so if we continue to see it be loose, the Fed is going to have a bias to keep raising rates. And so with the Fed being a bit more hawkish, we've got some of the Fed governors and a Fed president said, one example would be Lael Brainard, who had indicated that she was a very big dovish governor. And she had indicated that the Fed needed to be more restrictive. So if we think that neutral for the Fed could be 3%, which many think it could be, that for them to be restrictive, they would need to be at 3.25% to 3.5%, which would need another 4 to 5 rate increases. So certainly from their perspective, unless anything changes market-wise and conditions are still loose, there could be more rate increases to come. We do feel that there are a lot of risks on the horizon. You have the China-U.S. trade conflict taking place, and I know that we talk about tariffs, but we felt a lot of the conflict is a little bit longer term looking as far as theft of intellectual property, mandatory technology transfer, And there is this China Made in 2025 strategy. And we feel like that's going to have some major implications for U.S. companies. The goal, as far as this Made in China 2025 strategy, is that China's trying to break away from all the innovation barriers that they've been having to, they're trying to wean themselves off of importing technology. I mean, they want every technology company to come into their world, and you have to pay a price for it. And a lot of that is you're giving up some intellectual property. And we feel that this is going to be a bigger issue because they're eventually wanting to not have to rely on that, and it could have implications. Just last week, you had a Chinese state-owned company that was charged with conspiring to steal trade secrets from Micron Technology. So that's kind of like a situation where it happens, can happen, and I think that it can have implications for other big companies like Intel and Boeing and others, where they're wanting to eventually, as a goal, rely on less U.S. technology and affect corporations. Italy's banks are also a problem, and we feel that that is a significant risk, because Italy is the third largest economy in Europe, and it certainly has issues as far as their banking system and the European Union. And then lastly, we do have some concerns about corporate earnings, as far as looking into 2019, that those earnings are going to soften. Basically, earnings have benefited from tax cuts. And when you look at comparisons of 2017 to 2018, they were quite favorable. As you make a comparison to 2019 versus 18, it's going to be tougher comparisons. And with that backdrop, you have trade tensions, tariffs, and it's going to continue to put pressure on margins. And these companies are very competitive, and it will be a bit difficult for them to fully pass on this to the consumer through higher prices. So bottom line, we kind of think that there's going to be, a change in volatility. It's going to emerge and put pressure on risk assets. And as it relates to investment grade assets, we feel that we're going to see some spread widening. And treasuries are likely to be the beneficiary of that. And we've seen treasuries kind of lack some sponsorship. They've been trading in about a 3 to 3.25% range. And a lot of that, as we talked about earlier, was that you've got more deficit and more issuance of treasury. And then you also have where the hedging costs are a bit more expensive. So there's less foreign buyers into the market. But we think that risk assets will probably reprice themselves, and or we will see a economic slowdown, and it would incite a flight to quality. So we think if that does transpire, that the 10-year would then start trading more in that 2.5 to 3% range that we felt that it would trade within. So if you start to get wind of anything related to the recession, then rates could go even lower. So I guess amongst the other managers, we have certainly taken on a bit more of a defensive posture. Given that we're a longer manager, you have to kind of be a bit more defensive. And we feel markets have been a bit complacent for quite some time.
Any questions for Tim? Motion to accept, please.
Make a motion.
So?
A motion.
I'll say a motion, second. All in favor? Yeah, Sean Griffin?
Cap Cross Asset Management.
Thank you.
As you will, usual, I will keep this brief.
Okay, I'll start out with a sort of tangential subject, which is our fee. I was asked some many quarters ago to kind of keep track of the fees of the managers as well as Cap Trust. I've done that. You can see that the fees have remained pretty consistent from the fourth quarter of 2016 until third quarter of 18, right in that $44,000 range. So I would construe that as good news. The investment allocation currently is as shown. The managers are holding approximately $184 million, representing 88% of the total portfolio. The internal accounts, Florida Prime, Florida Fixed Income Trust, and SunTrust checking account, about $24,000. This is again as of 9/30. This is just a little bit. I'm sorry.
$24 million. $24,000 would be a little crazy.
Yeah, you just said that. Okay, so this is just a little more detail on the asset allocation. I think the key point here is that PFM Group is actually at 28.3% as opposed to the 30%. Sawgrass is a little overweight at 41.36, and Sykes is just about on at 30. And that's in accordance with our policy.
John, with the overweight, do you suggest that we move some dollars around so make it a little bit more even across the board?
Certainly, you have not really had a set rebalance policy as far as I know. As a matter of fact, I don't think we've ever actually talked about rebalance. It certainly wouldn't hurt, but from an academic standpoint, I don't know that it's really that important, that small a variance.
From our October action, I'll speak of it later. It kind of bounces out a little bit more.
There you go. Okay. There are a lot of schools of thought about rebalancing, and most of the schools of thought are very positive about it on a long-term basis, but if you overwork it, it becomes a little bit, shall we say, self-defeating. This is probably the most important page that we'll review here, and I think that some good points can be made. First of all, on the top, where it says the total portfolio with trailing performance, you can see that over the last 10 years, the portfolio actually has outperformed its policy benchmarks. And again, this is all on a net of fee basis. So the committee has done a good job, the managers have done a good job of maintaining, you know, getting the job done as the job was defined. Now, of course, we, especially over the last 3 years, it's been a very difficult environment for fixed income, and especially the last year. So what I wanted to point out is that on that top graph, all of those numbers are positive. At the end, with 31 basis points for the last quarter, again, on an annualized basis, that would come in at about 120. So it kind of reinforces the idea that maybe we've kind of, I'm not saying we haven't gotten past rate increases, but we're moving in that direction, and it's positive. If you look at the graph below, it merely shows the same numbers on an annualized basis, that's fiscal year basis, and those numbers, again, are almost all positive, with the only exception being the 2015 number, which was just a little bit shy of the total benchmark. This is a comparison of the fixed income managers, and relative to their universe that we're comparing, so this is their universe of peers as opposed to the benchmark. Now, your investment policy actually says that investment peer analysis is something that should be done, but it's not the primary factor in evaluating your managers. And again, these numbers are not quite as positive, but the reason for that, honestly, is that the universes are not that precise. So for instance, a short investment grade universe we're using for both PFM and Sawgrass, it's the best universe available, but it's not exactly what either of them are doing. So Sites is a little closer, but again, it's not precise. But anyway, it's a good thing to look at, and if in your own time, if you wanted to study that, it might be useful for you. This is just a statistical summary of the portfolio relative to a lot of different asset classes. You'll notice, I showed you this the last time I was here, your portfolio sits on the axis of the two lines, and we have pure cash on the left, along with Barclays Ag, U.S. equities, as represented by the Russell 3000, real estate investments, international equities. Obviously, those asset classes are far riskier, much more volatile, not suitable for this portfolio, but you can see the difference in terms of ultimate return. Not that anything should be done about it, I just wanted to point that out. And also cash at this point. Notice the cash falls to the left, less risk, but returns are less attractive. So that's about, that's all I really wanted. I had manager information, but we've really already seen that. So unless there are any further questions, that's our report.
I'll make a motion. That's
a second.
No, second.
That's it.
Yes.
All in favor?
All right.
Thank you, John. Mm-hmm. We have our internal report here. Shows the values. Biggest changes in our total value during the month of September. We withdrew the money from SBA and Florida Fit for liquidity needs. We had year-end debt payments. We had a large FMPA payment and also a true-up on our pension expense. So we withdrew $18.8 million. But overall, it was reduced $7.8 million. So we had some gains that month. And there's some of it still residing in SunTrust. It hadn't been processed at 9/30, so it'll be trued up in this next quarter. Any questions about that? And continuing professional education, just about everyone has completed it. I think there's one outlier. Oh, okay, you did complete it. We did complete it for the past 12 months. We appreciate that. PFM came up and gave two presentations, and we enjoy Steve's company. Plus, we get our education out of the way. We don't have to travel or spend the night anywhere or anything else. So. Thank you, PFM.
Sure. We have a couple webinars next week. If anybody is shy, we have a couple webinars next week. You can get a couple hours in each day, too. So.
Yes. I had to miss one of those, okay. 4 hours, so I was on two of them last week or week before last.
Right, right.
And, very informative, too.
Yes.
And the price is right. It's free. Wait, Mary, I'll go to the next one. Oh, do you have anything else? Okay. Contract renewals is the next matter we have up. I had a meeting with John Griffith and discussed, you know, our investment manager performance. I believe it was early September, John, is that correct? Late August, one of the two.
September.
And John came up, we had a good meeting, and discussed that, because we were thinking about reallocating or moving some things around. And after my meeting with John, we'd like to move forward with one-year renewals for everybody, which is allowed by the current contract for three investment managers to expire in February. And John Griffith, his contract expires in December. We're going to go for 1 year renewal for everybody and reassess that midway through next year.
Okay.
Okay.
Sounds great. Need a motion?
I don't think we need a motion.
I would.
Well, let's go ahead and do one. A motion to move forward with contract
renewal. 1 year renewal. Okay.
Right. A second. All in favor?
All right.
I'd also like to say thank you to the investment managers who came through in October. We withdrew $20 million from our investment accounts. And we needed that for a pension prepayment we're doing. We're saving almost $900,000 by doing a pension prepayment for the year or expense. So if you go by basis points, I mean, it should be, it's over 400 basis points if you extrapolate it out to a year. I know it's not completely accurate, but we still, we save a big chunk of money for the city going forward. We hope to put everything back in the investment accounts before we get to the end of the year, especially the money markets, because we took everything out of there for liquidity needs. And that's why we have them, though. We have them there for that, for liquidity needs. Everybody responded, though. We had the money in Wells Fargo. We took the money out, so and in this quarter, you'll see the different numbers.
We plan to do that on an annual basis.
Yes. Annually, we'll probably need that. Well, it should go down, right, Tim? I think the long-term should go down below $20 million for that prepayment, we think. As more people retire...
I don't want to presume that.
To, yeah.
Right. I think it's more the hybrid and the older pension categories retired, our expenses go down. And our allocation percentage-wise is very close. I was just doing a rough estimate. It's very close with 30, 30, and 40. So it should be very close when we get to the end of this quarter. Okay. Anybody have anything else? Thanks for coming up and presenting today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Happy holidays. See you all next year.
That's right. We'll see you next year.